There is a specific feeling you get when you check your brokerage account and see a dividend payment. It's not a huge amount of money, usually, maybe enough for a nice lunch or a tank of gas, but it feels safe.
It feels like winning.
Yeah.
It's tangible proof that the company is real and it's making money. It's the bird in the hand.
Exactly. It's the bird in the hand. But then you look at the other side of the fence, you hear stories about people who bought a stock 20 years ago, forgot about it, and woke up to find it had multiplied their money by 10, 20, maybe 100 times, the elusive multi-bagger.
The dream scenario.
Right. And you look at your safe, steady dividend payer and you realize this thing hasn't really moved in 5 years. And that brings up the big question. What actually separates a stock that just kind of exists and pays you a little rent from one that explodes in value and, changes your life?
It is the holy grail question of investing.
Yeah.
And usually people think the answer is about finding the next massive tech invention, find the next iPhone.
Right.
But today we're looking at a fascinating source that argues the secret isn't necessarily the product, it's the math.
The math.
Specifically, the math of where the money goes.
We are doing a deep dive today into a document titled Simply Reinvestment Opportunities. And what I love about this is the backstory of the author.
It's great.
This isn't some aggressive growth investor from Silicon Valley. This is an investor who literally wrote a book called Dividend Vault.
That's what makes this so compelling. This is someone who built their entire identity, their entire strategy on cash in hand, safe, reliable dividends.
Totally.
But the source material is essentially a confession. It's a document of a strategic crisis, or maybe an awakening is a better word, where they realize they've been looking at the equation wrong for years.
It's a total road to Damascus moment for a finance guy. And it centers on this tension, right, between the comfort of getting paid now versus the compounding engine of keeping the money in the company. So our mission today is to unpack that engine. We're going to look at the capital allocation test. We're going to look at a really specific mathematical face-off between two hypothetical stocks, and we're going to find out why this former dividend lover thinks we should be suspicious of that quarterly check.
It's a complete mindset shift. It moves you from asking, how much are you paying me today, to what are you building for me for tomorrow?
Okay, let's unpack this. We need to start where the author started. The catalyst for this whole epiphany was a company called the Markel Group.
Yes, Markel. In financial circles, you'll often hear Markel referred to as a baby Berkshire or a mini Berkshire.
Which is pretty much the highest praise you can get in this world.
It really is. Markel started as a specialty insurance company. They insure, niche things, summer camps, classic cars, vacant building stuff the big guys ignore. But like Berkshire Hathaway, they realized that the insurance business generates a lot of float.
Float being the cash that sits around between the time a customer pays a premium and the time the company has to pay out a claim.
Exactly. It's free money to invest in the interim. And the magic happens in what you do with that cash.
Okay.
This is where the CEO, Thomas Gaynor, comes in. He's a legend in value investing. And Gaynor runs Markel based on four foundational principles, a checklist for acquiring companies.
I love a good
Our
checklist.
author, the dividend guy, was studying this checklist and realized he was only hitting three of them.
Okay, walk us through the checklist. What was he getting right and what was the missing piece?
So the first two are pretty standard for any value investor. Number one, the company must have good returns on capital and low leverage.
Right.
Basically, is it a profitable business that isn't drowning in debt?
Solid. That's investing 101. You don't want to buy a sinking ship. Check.
Number two, management must have equal parts talent and integrity. Again, hard to argue with. You want honest, smart people running the show.
Check.
We'll skip to number four for a second. Number four is the price has to be reasonable. You don't overpay for the asset.
Okay. Buy low, sell high. So, profitable business, good managers, fair price. That sounds like the complete package. If I find a stock that hits those three, I'm buying it.
And that's exactly what our author did. He bought companies that fit those three criteria perfectly.
Right.
And usually, because these were profitable, mature companies, they paid nice, healthy dividends. But here's the kicker. He noticed that while his portfolio was safe, it wasn't compounding. It wasn't creating that life-changing wealth.
Because he missed principle number three.
Principle number three is reinvestment opportunities, or simply capital discipline.
Reinvestment opportunities. It sounds a bit dry, but let's break that down. This is the idea that the company has somewhere to put the money back into the business to make it grow, right?
Precisely. the author realized that the companies he loved, the ones sending him dividend checks, were failing this third test.
Wow.
He says they were winning the first half of the battle. They were making profits. They were generating cash. But they were failing the second half of the battle.
And the second half is?
The second half is the question. What do we do with the money we just made to generate more value?
That is such a critical distinction. Winning the first half, failing the second. It's like a football team that plays great defense, never lets the other team score, but has absolutely no offense.
That's a great analogy.
You're not going to lose, but you're not really going to win big either.
That's it. Because if a company pays you a dividend, they are effectively saying, we have no offense. We don't have a new factory to build. We don't have a competitor to acquire. We don't have a new product line that offers a high return. So here, you take the cash.
It changes how you view the dividend notification on your phone. Instead of, yay, money.
It's almost like the CEO is admitting defeat.
Sort of.
They're saying, I'm out of ideas. You handle this.
In the context of seeking a multi-bagger, a stock that goes up 10x or 20x, yes, that is the signal. And this brings us to what the source calls the capital allocation test.
Okay.
It references a really famous concept from Warren Buffett's 2012 shareholder letter.
Buffett is the master of this. How does he frame it? He boils it down to what's often called the $1 rule. The test is simple. For every dollar of earnings that a company retains, meaning they don't pay it out to you, can they create more than $1 of market value over time?
Okay, so let's play that out. I'm a shareholder. The company earns a dollar of profit that theoretically belongs to me.
Right.
If they keep it, they need to turn that dollar into $1.50 or $2 of stock value down the road.
Correct. If they can take that dollar, invest it in a new project, and earn a 20% return on it, the stock market will eventually reward that growth. The value of the company goes up by more than the dollar they kept.
But if they take my dollar, keep it, and spend it on a fancy new headquarters, or a corporate jet, or a bad acquisition that only earns a 2% return,
then they have destroyed value. They turned your dollar into 90 cents. In that case, they should have just given you the dollar.
So the dividend is the fail-safe. It's what you do when you can't pass the $1 rule.
Exactly. And the source material takes a pretty controversial stance here. The author suggests that, ideally, dividends should only be paid when a company has completely run out of ideas.
Run out of ideas? That sounds harsh. It sounds like we're insulting these stable companies.
It does, but think about it from a cold, hard math perspective. If you are a CEO and you have a machine in your basement that turns $1 into $1.20,
yeah,
you would never turn that machine off to hand out cash to people. You would feed every penny you could find into the machine. You only hand out cash when the machine is full or broken.
That actually makes perfect sense. Prioritize the reinvestment if the return is there. If the return isn't there, give it back.
And this isn't just theory. The source gives us a historical example that illustrates this perfectly. It's a what-if scenario involving See's Candies.
Oh, I love this example. See's Candies is legendary in the Buffett lore. Bought in 1972, right?
1972. Berkshire Hathaway pays $25 million for it. Now, See's is a great business. They have massive share of mind in California. People love the chocolate. They can raise prices every year without losing customers. It prinks money.
It's the ultimate cash cow.
But here is the problem. It's candy. There is a physical limit to how much candy people will eat.
Especially premium box chocolate. It's a niche. You can't put a See's candy shop on every corner in America.
Right. It doesn't travel well. So the source asks us to imagine a parallel universe. Imagine Berkshire never bought them. Imagine See's Candies remained a standalone, publicly traded company on the stock market.
Okay, I'm picturing it. I'm the CEO of standalone See's. I'm making millions in profit every year. But I can't open 500 new stores because they won't work in Florida or New York. The brand doesn't resonate there.
Exactly. You've saturated your market. You have hit the ceiling of your reinvestment opportunities within the candy business.
Oh.
So what do you do with the cash piling up in the bank?
I guess I have to pay a dividend.
You have to.
Yeah.
Or you buy back shares. You have to return the capital to shareholders because you, as a candy company board, don't know anything about steel mills or insurance or underwear.
Right.
You are stuck in your circle of competence, which is chocolate.
And if I pay out all that cash as dividends, the company itself stops growing. The value of the stock flattens out. It becomes a bond that pays a coupon.
Precisely. It stays a small, profitable regional business. But because Berkshire bought them, something different happened. This is the conglomerate advantage.
Because Berkshire isn't a candy company.
Berkshire is a capital allocation machine. When See's sent those millions of dollars of profit up to Omaha, Warren Buffett didn't have to put it back into chocolate.
No.
He could look at the entire global economy.
He could take the candy money and buy.
What did you buy?
The Source has a list, and it's pretty wild.
It's an incredible list. The Source highlights that the cash flows from See's help fund investments in Marmon Group.
That's industrial manufacturing. Pipes and wire.
Richline, which is jewelry. Johns Manville, building products. Jazzwares, toys. Duracell, batteries. Shaw Industries, carpet. Brooks Sports, running shoes. Fruit of the Loom, underwear. Lubrizol, specialty chemicals.
That is just... It's amazing when you trace the dollar, you trace it back, and it turns out the profit from a box of chocolates in San Francisco in 1980 helped buy a battery company in 2014.
That is the magic. Because Berkshire could reallocate that capital into high-return businesses across any industry, they never had to pay a dividend. They could keep compounding that money internally, year after year, decade after decade.
So if Seen had stayed independent, the growth stops at the California border. By being part of a reinvestment engine, the capital kept growing forever.
And that is the definition of a multi-bagger. It's not just about earning the money. It's about the ability to recycle that money at high rates of return.
Okay, so qualitatively, I get it. We want companies that can act like mini Berkshires, taking their cash and finding new ways to grow it. But the author of this Source document is a numbers guy.
He is.
He don't just want to talk about candy. He wanted to prove this mathematically.
Yes, and this is the core of the document. This is where he proves why the dividend vault strategy was flawed for growth. He sets up a head-to-head battle between two hypothetical stocks over a 20-year period, stock A versus stock B.
Let's set the stage for the listener. This is a battle for your portfolio. What are the starting stats for our contenders?
They are identical twins at birth. Both companies start with $100 million in shareholder equity.
Okay.
Both have 1 million shares outstanding. So the book value per share is $100.
Okay. What about performance?
Both are excellent businesses. They both earn a 15% return on equity, an ROE of 15%.
15% ROE is solid. That's a high-quality business. That means for every dollar of equity, they generate 15 cents of profit.
It is. And the market recognizes that quality, so both stocks trade at a price-to-earnings ratio, a PE, of 20.
Okay, so identical size, identical profitability, identical valuation. Where do they diverge?
Strategy. Stock A is our dividend pair. It follows the strategy the author used to follow.
The crowd pleaser. The one that pays for my lunch.
Stock A pays out 100% of its earnings as dividends. Every year, whatever they make, they mail it to you. They retain nothing.
Okay. And stock B?
Stock B is the compounder. It pays zero dividends. It retains 100% of its earnings, and, this is the crucial assumption, it is able to reinvest all that money back into the business while maintaining that 15% return on equity.
Okay, so stock B is the machine in the basement that never gets turned off. It keeps eating its own cooking. Let's fast forward 20 years. What happens to stock A, the dividend lover?
Well, let's trace the equity. They start with $100 million. In year one, they make $15 million. That's their 15% ROE. They pay out $15 million, so they end the year with...
$100 million. The equity base never grows.
It's flat for 20 years, which means the earnings are flat. They make $15 million in year one, and they make $15 million in year 20.
So the company is essentially running on a treadmill. It's working hard, producing cash, but it's not going anywhere.
And because earnings are flat, the stock price is flat. Assuming the P.E. ratio stays at 20, the stock price starts at $300 and ends at $300 two decades later.
Oof. 20 years.
Yes.
Zero capital appreciation. Now, to be fair, the shareholder did get checks in the mail.
Yes. They received a 5% dividend yield every year. That's not nothing. If they spent that money, they have nothing to show for it in terms of wealth accumulation.
Right.
If they reinvested the dividends themselves, well, then they're doing the work, not the company.
Right.
But the stock itself, it's a bond. It's a savings account.
That is underwhelming, especially when we compare it to stock B. Let's look at the compounder. Here is where it gets really interesting.
This is where the exponential math kicks in. Year one, stock B earns $15 million.
Uh-huh.
It keeps it. So year two, the equity base isn't $100 million anymore. It's $115 million.
And 15% of $115 million is a bigger number than 15% of $100 million.
Exactly. The earnings jump to $17.25 million. They keep that too. Now the base is $132 million. The next year, the earnings are bigger again. You do this for 20 years, yeah. The equity base grows from $100 billion to $1.423 billion.
Wait, repeat that. From $100 million to $1.4 billion.
Yes. That is the power of compounding at 15%. And look at the earnings. The earnings rise from $15 million a year to $213 million a year.
And since the stock price usually follows the earnings,
if we apply that same 20x PE multiple, the share price rises from $300 to $4,270.
$4,270.
It is a 14-bagger. You multiplied your money by roughly 14 times.
That is staggering when you see the numbers side by side like that. And just to be clear for the listener, the underlying business performance was the same.
Identical.
Both companies were good at making widgets or selling insurance. They both had a 15% ROE.
The only difference was capital allocation decision. One gave the fuel away, the other put the fuel back into the engine.
This really highlights why the author had this crisis of faith. If you are chasing stock A because you like the safe dividend, you are mathematically capping your upside. You are explicitly choosing not to get the 14-bagger.
And that's the trade-off. Stock A provides good returns. Stock B provides great returns. And the gap between good and great over 20 years is the difference between having a little extra spending money and having generational wealth.
But we have to play devil's advocate here. We have to be realistic. There is a catch, right? Stock B sounds perfect, but it relies on a massive assumption.
It relies on trust. You have to trust that the management can actually find places to invest that money at 15%.
Right. Because as companies get bigger, it gets harder to grow. It's the law of large numbers.
Exactly. This is the danger zone. If Stock B keeps the money but runs out of good ideas and starts investing in projects that only earn 5% or 0%,
right,
we call empire building, then you don't get the 14-bagger. You get a bloated, inefficient company that destroys value.
So when you forego the dividend, you are taking a risk. You are handing your cash to the CEO and saying, I trust you can do better with this than I can.
Precisely. You aren't just betting on the horse, you're betting on the jockey.
Right.
Ideally, you want a jockey like Thomas Gaynor or Warren Buffett or the Rales brothers at Danaher, people who have proven over decades that they can take a dollar and turn it into five.
So bringing this back to the author's conclusion, after doing this math, after seeing the 14-bagger potential, does he sell all his dividend stocks? Does he go full growth mode?
He's surprisingly balanced about it. He concludes that he isn't going to abandon dividends completely. He mentions keeping national champions and companies that are just so high quality, he can't let them go.
Like the actual See's Candies. Sometimes a cash cow is nice to have in a recession.
Exactly. Stability has value. You need to sleep at night. But the big shift, the mission of this deep dive, is that he is consciously shifting his focus. He wants to challenge himself to develop the skill set to find the stock bees.
He wants to hunt for the compounders.
He's getting comfortable with the discomfort of not getting paid today. He's learning to look at a company that pays zero dividends and say, that's okay, because I trust you're building something bigger for me.
It's almost like the marshmallow test for investors, you know, the psychological test for kids. You can have one marshmallow now, the dividend.
Right.
Or if you wait, you can have two marshmallows later.
Except in this case, thanks to the magic of 15% compounding, if you wait 20 years, you get 14 marshmallows.
I'll take the 14 marshmallows. It really forces you to look at your own portfolio differently. I'm thinking about the stocks I own right now.
It's a healthy exercise. And it leads to a very specific question for our listeners.
Lay it on us.
Go through your portfolio. Look at the companies that are paying you dividends right now. And ask yourself, why are they paying me?
Are they paying me because they love me?
They definitely don't love you. Are they paying you because they are a mature, stable cash cow? That's fine. Or are they paying you because the management team has simply run out of ideas?
That is the provocative thought. Is that dividend a reward? Or is it a white flag of surrender? We can't grow anymore, so here's some cash.
If you're holding a company that has run out of ideas, you probably aren't holding the next multi-bagger.
A powerful lens to view your investments through. Are you holding an engine or a savings account? That's it for this deep dive into the mechanics of the multi-bagger. Hopefully, we've given you something to calculate.
Happy investing.
See you next time.